rolled over a big round stone and dropped down again. The horses were dark with sweat and lathered under collar and breeching. "I'll be glad to talk to him," said Adam. "Well, sir, he raised one fine crop. He had good children, and he raised them fine. All doing well. Maybe except Joe. Joe, he's the youngest. They're talking about sending him to college. But all the rest are doing fine. Mr. Hamilton can be proud. The house is just on the other side of the next rise. Don't forget and bring out that whiskey. She'll freeze you to the ground." The dry earth was ticking under the sun, and the crickets rasped. "It's real God-forsaken country," said Lewis. "Makes me feel mean," said Adam. "How's that?" "Well, I'm fixed so I don't have to live in a place like this." "Me too, and I don't feel mean. I'm just goddamn glad." When the buckboard topped the rise, Adam could look down on the little cluster of buildings which composed the Hamilton seat. A house with many lean-tos, a cowshed, a shop, and a wagon shed. It was a dry and sun-eaten sight. No big trees, and a small, hand-watered garden. Lewis turned to Adam, and there was just a hint of hostility in his tone.
"I want to put you straight on one or two things, Mr. Trask. There's people that when they see Samuel Hamilton the first time might get the idea he's full of bull. He don't talk like other people. He's an Irishman, and he's all full of plans, 100 plans a day, and he's all full of hope. My Christ, he'd have to live on this land. But you remember this, he's a fine worker, a good blacksmith, and some of his plans work out. And I've heard him talk about things that were going to happen, and they did." Adam was alarmed at the hint of threat. "I'm not a man to run another man down," he said, and he felt that suddenly Lewis thought of him as a stranger and an enemy.
"I just wanted you to get it straight. There's some people come in from the East, and they think if a man hasn't got a lot of money, he's no good."
"I wouldn't think of..."
"Mr. Hamilton maybe hasn't got 4 bits put away, but he's our people, and he's as good as we got. And he's raised the nicest family you're likely to see. I just want you to remember that."
Adam was on the point of defending himself, and then he said, "I'll remember. Thanks for telling me."
Lewis faced around front again. "There he is, see? Out by the shop? He must have heard us."
"Has he got a beard?" Adam asked, peering.
"Yes, got a nice beard. It's turning white fast, beginning to grizzle up."
They drove past the frame house and saw Mrs. Hamilton looking out the window at them, and they drew up in front of the shop where Samuel stood waiting for them.
Adam saw a big man, bearded like a patriarch, his graying hair stirring in the air like thistledown. His cheeks above his beard were pink where the sun had burned his Irish skin. He wore a clean blue shirt, overalls, and a leather apron. His sleeves were rolled up, and his muscular arms were clean, too. Only his hands were blackened from the forge. After a quick glance, Adam came back to the eyes, light blue and filled with young delight. The wrinkles around them were drawn in radial lines inward by laughter.
"Lewis," he said, "I'm glad to see you. Even in the sweetness of our little heaven here, we like to see our friends."
He smiled at Adam, and Lewis said,
"I brought Mr. Adam Trask to see you. He's a stranger from down east, come to settle."
"I'm glad," said Samuel. "We'll shake another time. I won't soil your hand with these forge hooks."
"I brought some strap iron, Mr. Hamilton. Would you make some angles for me? The whole frame of my header bed has fallen to hell."
"Sure I will, Lewis. Get down, get down. We'll put the horses to the shade. There's a piece of venison behind, and Mr. Trask brought a little something."
Samuel glanced toward the house.
"Maybe we'll get out the little something when we've got the rig behind the shed."
Adam could hear the singing lilt of his speech, and yet could detect no word pronounced in a strange manner, except perhaps in sharpened T's and L's held high on the tongue.
"Lewis, will you outspan your team? I'll take the venison in. Liza will be glad. She likes a venison stew."
"Any of the young ones home?"
"Well, no, they aren't.
George and Will came home for the weekend, and they all went last night to a dance up Wild Horse Canyon at the Peachtree Schoolhouse. They'll come trooping back by dusk. We lack a sofa because of that. I'll tell you later. Liza will have a vengeance on them. It was Tom did it. I'll tell you later.
He laughed and started toward the house, carrying the wrapped deer's haunch.
If you want, you can bring the little something into the shop, so you don't let the sun glint on it.
They heard him calling as he came near the house.
Liza, you'll never guess. Louis Lippo has brought a piece of venison bigger than you.
Louis drove in back of the shed, and Adam helped him take the horses out, tie up the tugs, and halter them in the shade.
He meant that about the sun shining on the bottle, said Louis. She must be a holy terror. No bigger than a bird, but she's brass-bound.
Outspan, Adam said. I think I've heard it said that way, or read it.
Samuel rejoined them in the shop. Liza will be happy if you will stay to dinner, he said.
She didn't expect us, Adam protested.
Harsh, man. She'll make some extra dumplings for the stew. It's a pleasure to have you here. Give me your straps, Louis, and let's see how you want them.
He built a chip fire in the black square of the forge and pulled a bellows breeze on it, and then fed wet coke over with his fingers until it glowed.
Here, Louis, he said, wave your wing on my fire. Slow, man, slow and even.
He laid the strips of iron on the glowing coke.
No, sir, Mr. Trask, Liza's used to cooking for 9 starving children. Nothing can startle her.
He tongued the iron to more advantageous heat, and he laughed.
I'll take that last back as a holy lie, he said. My wife is rumbling like round stones in the surf, and I'll caution the both of you not to mention the word sofa. It's a word of anger and sorrow to Liza.
You said something about it, Adam said.
If you knew my boy Tom, you'd understand it better, Mr. Trask. Louis knows him.
Sure I know him,
Louis said. Samuel went on.
My Tom is a hell-bent boy. Always takes more on his plate than he can eat. Always plants more than he can harvest. Pleasure's too much, sorrow's too much. Some people are like that. Liza thinks I'm like that. I don't know what will come to Tom. Maybe greatness, maybe the noose. Well, Hamiltons have been hanged before, and I'll tell you about that sometime.
The sofa? Adam suggested politely.
You're right. I do, and Liza says I do, shepherd my words like rebellious sheep. Well, came the dance at the Peachtree School, and the boys, George, Tom, Will, and Joe, all decided to go. And, of course, the girls were asked. George and Will and Joe, poor simple boys, each asked one lady friend. But Tom, he took too big a helping as usual. He asked 2 William sisters, Jenny and Belle. How many screw holes do you want, Louis?
5, said Louis.
All right. Now, I must tell you, Mr. Trask, that my Tom has all the egotism and self-love of a boy who thinks he's ugly. Mostly lets himself go fallow. Becomes a celebration, and he garlands himself like a maypole. And he glories like spring flowers. This takes him quite a piece of time. You notice the wagon house was empty? George and Will and Joe started early, and not so beautiful as Tom. George took the rig, Will had the buggy, and Joe got the little 2-wheeled cart.
Samuel's blue eyes shone with pleasure.
Well, then Tom came out as shy and shining as a Roman emperor, and the only thing left with wheels was a hay rake. And you can't take even 1 William sister on that. For good or bad, Liza was taking her nap. Tom sat on the steps and thought it out. Then I saw him go to the shed and hitch up 2 horses and take the double tree off the hayrake. He wrestled the sofa out of the house and ran a 5th chain under the legs. The fine gooseneck horsehair sofa that Liza loves better than anything. I gave it to her to rest on before George was born. Last I saw, Tom went dragging up the hill, reclining at his ease on the sofa to get the Williams girls. And, oh, Lord, it'll be worn thin as a wafer from scraping by the time he gets it back.
Samuel put down his tongs and placed his hands on his hips, the better to laugh.
And Liza has the smoke of brimstone coming out her nostrils. Poor Tom.
Adam said, smiling. Would you like to take a little something?
That I would, said Samuel.
He accepted the bottle and took a quick swallow of whiskey and passed it back.
Isquabaugh. It's an Irish word. Whiskey, water of life. And so it is.
He took the red straps to his anvil and punched screw holes in them, and bent the angles with his hammer, and the forked sparks leaped out. Then he dipped the iron, hissing, into his half-barrel of black water.
There you are,
he said, and threw them on the ground.
Why, thank you, said Lewis. How much will that be?
The pleasure of your company.
It's always like that,
Lewis said helplessly.
No. When I put your new well down, you paid my price. That reminds me, Mr. Trask here is thinking of buying the Bordoni place, the old Sanchez grant, you remember?
I know it well, said Samuel.
It's a fine piece. He was asking about water, and I told him you knew more about that than anybody around here.
Adam passed the bottle, and Samuel took a delicate sip and wiped his mouth on his forearm above the soot.
I haven't made up my mind, said Adam. I'm just asking some questions.
Oh, Lord, man, now you put your foot in it. They say it's a dangerous thing to question an Irishman because he'll tell you.
I hope you know what you're doing when you issue me a license to talk. I've heard two ways of looking at it. One says the silent man is the wise man, and the other that a man without words is a man without thought. Naturally, I favor the second. Liza says to a fault. What do you want to know?
Well, take the Bordoni place. How deep would you have to go to get water?
I'd have to see the spot. Some places 30 feet, some places 150, and in some places clear to the center of the world.
But you could develop water?
Nearly every place except my own.
I've heard you have a lack here.
Heard? Why, God in heaven must have heard. I screamed it loud enough.
There's a 400-acre piece beside the river. Would there be water under it?
I'd have to look. It seems to me it's an odd valley. If you'll hold your patience close, maybe I can tell you a little bit about it. For I have looked at it and poked my stinger down into it. A hungry man gorges with his mind. He does indeed.
Lewis Lippo said, Mr. Trask is from New England. He plans to settle here. He's been west before, though, in the army, fighting Indians.
Were you now? Then it's you should talk and let me learn.
I don't want to talk about it.
Why not? God help my family and my neighbors if I had fought the Indians.
I didn't want to fight them, sir. The sir crept in without his knowing it.
Yes, I can understand that. It must be a hard thing to kill a man you don't know and don't hate.
Maybe that makes it easier, said Lewis.
You have a point, Lewis. But some men are friends with the whole world in their hearts. And there are others that hate themselves and spread their hatred around like butter on hot bread.
I'd rather you told me about this land, Adam said uneasily, for a sick picture of piled-up bodies came into his mind.
What time is it?
Lewis stepped out and looked at the sun.
Not past 10 o'clock. If I get started, I have no self-control. My son Will says I talk to trees when I can't find a human vegetable.
He sighed and sat down on a nail keg.
I said it was a strange valley, but maybe that's because I was born in a green place. Do you find it strange, Lewis?
No, I'd never been out of it.
I've dug into it plenty, Samuel said. Something went on under it. Maybe still is going on. There's an ocean bed underneath, and below that, another world. But that needn't bother a farming man. Now, on top is good soil, particularly on the flats. In the upper valley, it's light and sandy. But mixed in with that, the top sweetness of the hills that wash down on it in the winters. As you go north, the valley widens out, and the soil gets blacker and heavier, and perhaps richer. It's my belief that marshes were there once, and the roots of centuries rotted into the soil and made it black and fertilized it. And when you turn it up,
A little greasy clay mixes and holds it together. That's from about Gonzales, north to the river mouth. Off to the sides, around Salinas and Blanco and Castroville and Moss Landing, the marshes are still there. And when one day those marshes are drained off, that will be the richest of all land in this red world. He always tells what it'll be like someday, Lewis threw in. Well, a man's mind can't stay in time the way his body does. If I'm going to settle here, I need to know about how and what will be, said Adam. My children, when I have them, will be on it. Samuel's eyes looked over the heads of his friends, out of the dark forge to the yellow sunlight. You'll have to know that under a good part of the valley, some places deep and others pretty near the surface, there's a layer called hardpan. It's a clay, hard-packed, and it feels greasy, too. Some places it's only a foot thick, and more in others. And this hardpan resists water. If it weren't there, the winter rains would go soaking down and dampen the earth, and in the summer it would rise up to the roots again. But when the earth above the hardpan is soaked full, the rest runs freshening off or stands rotting on top. That's one of the main curses of our valley. Well, it's a pretty good place to live, isn't it? Yes, it is. But a man can't entirely rest when he knows it could be richer. I've thought that if you could drive thousands of holes through it to let the water in, it might solve it. And then I tried something with a few sticks of dynamite. I punched a hole through the hard pan and blasted. That broke it up, and the water would get down. But God in heaven, think of the amount of dynamite. I've read that a Swede, the same man who invented dynamite, has got a new explosive, stronger and safer. Maybe that might be the answer. Lewis said half derisively and half with admiration. He's always thinking about how to change things. He's never satisfied with the way they are. Samuel smiled at them. They say man lived in trees one time. Somebody had to get dissatisfied with a high limb, or your feet wouldn't be touching flat ground now. And then he laughed again. I can see myself sitting on my dust heap, making a world in my mind as surely as God created this one. But God saw his world. I'll never see mine except this way. This will be a valley of great richness one day. It could feed the world, and maybe it will. And happy people will live here, thousands and thousands. A cloud seemed to come over his eyes, and his face set in sadness, and he was silent. You make it sound like a good place to settle, Adam said. Where else could I raise my children with that coming? Samuel went on. There's a thing I don't understand. There's a blackness on this valley. I don't know what it is, but I can feel it. Sometimes on a white, blinding day, I can feel it cutting off the sun and squeezing the light out of it like a sponge. His voice rose. There's a black violence on this valley. I don't know. I don't know. It's as though some old ghost haunted it out of the dead ocean below and troubled the air with unhappiness. It's as secret as hidden sorrow. I don't know what it is, but I see it and feel it in the people here. Adam shivered. I just remembered I promised to get back early. Kathy, my wife, is going to have a baby. But Liza's getting ready. She'll understand when you tell her about the baby. My wife is feeling poorly, and I thank you for telling me about the water. Have I depressed you with my rambling? No, not at all. Not at all. It's Kathy's first baby, and she's miserable. Adam struggled all night with his thoughts, and the next day he drove out and shook hands with Bordoni, and the Sanchez place was his. Chapter 14. There is so much to tell about the Western country in that day that it's hard to know where to start. One thing sets off 100 others. The problem is to decide which one to tell first. You remember that Samuel Hamilton said his children had gone to a dance at the Peachtree School. The country schools were the centers of culture then. The Protestant churches in the towns were fighting for their existence in a country where there were newcomers.
The Catholic Church, first on the scene and deeply dug in, sat in comfortable tradition, while the missions were gradually abandoned and their roofs fell in and pigeons roosted on the stripped altars. The library, in Latin and Spanish, of the San Antonio Mission was thrown into a granary, where the rats ate off the sheepskin bindings. In the country, the repository of art and science was the school, and the schoolteacher shielded and carried the torch of learning and of beauty. The schoolhouse was the meeting place for music, for debate. The polls were set in the schoolhouse for elections. Social life, whether it was the crowning of a May Queen, the eulogy to a dead president, or an all-night dance, could be held nowhere else. And the teacher was not only an intellectual paragon and a social leader, but also the matrimonial catch of the countryside. A family could indeed walk proudly if a son married a schoolteacher. Her children were presumed to have intellectual advantages, both inherited and conditioned. The daughters of Samuel Hamilton were not destined to become work-destroyed farm wives. They were handsome girls, and they carried with them the glow of their descent from the kings of Ireland. They had a pride that transcended their poverty. No one ever thought of them as deserving pity. Samuel raised a distinctly superior breed. They were better read and better bred than most of their contemporaries. To all of them, Samuel communicated his love of learning, and he set them apart from the prideful ignorance of their time. Olive Hamilton became a teacher. That meant that she left home at 15 and went to live in Salinas, where she could go to secondary school. At 17, she took county board examinations, which covered all the arts and sciences, and at 18, she was teaching school at Peachtree. In her school, there were pupils older and bigger than she was. It required great tact to be a schoolteacher. To keep order among the big, undisciplined boys without pistol and bullwhip was a difficult and dangerous business. In one school in the mountains, a teacher was raped by her pupils. Olive Hamilton had not only to teach everything, but to all ages. Very few youths went past the 8th grade in those days, and what with farm duties, some of them took 14 or 15 years to do it. Olive also had to practice a rudimentary medicine, for there were constant accidents. She sewed up knife cuts after a fight in the schoolyard. When a small, barefooted boy was bitten by a rattlesnake, it was her duty to suck his toe to draw the poison out. She taught reading to the 1st grade and algebra to the 8th. She led the singing, acted as a critic of literature, wrote the social notes that went weekly to the Salinas Journal. In addition, the whole social life of the area was in her hands. Not only graduation exercises, but dances, meetings, debates, chorals, Christmas and May Day festivals, patriotic exudations on Decoration Day and the 4th of July. She was on the election board and headed and held together all charities. It was far from an easy job, and it had duties and obligations beyond belief. The teacher had no private life. She was watched jealously for any weakness of character. She couldn't board with one family for more than one term, for that would cause jealousy. A family gains social ascendancy by boarding the teacher. If a marriageable son belonged to the family where she boarded, a proposal was automatic. If there was more than one claimant, vicious fights occurred over her hand. The Aguita boys, three of them, nearly clawed each other to death over Olive Hamilton. Teachers rarely lasted very long in the country schools. The work was so hard and the proposals so constant that they married within a very short time. This was a course Olive Hamilton determined she would not take. She didn't share the intellectual enthusiasms of her father, but the time she had spent in Salinas determined her not to be a ranch wife. She wanted to live in a town, perhaps not so big as Salinas, but at least not a crossroads. In Salinas, Olive had experienced niceties of living, the choir and vestments, altar guild, and bean suppers of the Episcopal Church. She had partaken of the arts, road companies of plays and even operas, with their magic and promise of an aromatic world outside. She had gone to parties, played charades, competed in poetry readings, joined a chorus and orchestra. Salinas had tempted her. There she could go to a party, dressed for a party, and come home in the same dress, instead of rolling her clothes in a saddlebag and riding 10 miles, then unrolling and pressing them. Busy though she was with her teaching, Olive longed for the metropolitan life. And when the young man who had built the flour mill in King City sued properly for her hand, she accepted him, subject to a long and secret engagement. The secrecy was required because if it were known, there would be trouble among the young men in the neighborhood. Olive had not her father's brilliance, but she did have a sense of fun, together with her mother's strong and undeviating will. What light and beauty could be forced down the throats of her reluctant pupils, she forced. There was a wall against learning. A man wanted his children to read, to figure, and that was enough. More might make them dissatisfied and flighty. And there were plenty of examples to prove that learning made a boy leave the farm to live in the city, to consider himself better than his father. Enough arithmetic to measure land and lumber and to keep accounts, enough writing to order goods and write to relatives, enough reading for newspapers, almanacs, and farm journals, enough music for religious and patriotic display. That was enough to help a boy and not lead him astray. Learning was for doctors, lawyers, and teachers, a class set off and not considered related to other people. There were some sports, of course, like Samuel Hamilton, and he was tolerated and liked. But if he hadn't been able to dig a well, shoe a horse, or run a threshing machine, God knows what would have been thought of the family. Olive did marry her young man and did move, first to Paso Robles, then to King City, and finally to Salinas. She was as intuitive as a cat. Her acts were based on feelings rather than thoughts. She had her mother's firm chin and button nose and her father's fine eyes. She was the most definite of any of the Hamiltons except her mother. Her theology was a curious mixture of Irish fairies and an Old Testament Jehovah, whom in her later life she confused with her father. Heaven was to her a nice home ranch, inhabited by her dead relatives. External realities of a frustrating nature she obliterated by refusing to believe in them. And when one resisted her disbelief, she raged at it. It was told of her that she cried bitterly because she couldn't go to 2 dances on one Saturday night. One was in Greenfield and the other in San Lucas, 20 miles apart. To have gone to both and then home would have entailed a 60-mile horseback ride. This was a fact she could not blast with her disbelief, and so she cried with vexation and went to neither dance. As she grew older, she developed a scattergun method for dealing with unpleasant facts. When I, her only son, was 16, I contracted pleural pneumonia. In that day, a killing disease. I went down and down until the wingtips of the angels brushed my eyes. Olive used her scattergun method of treating pleural pneumonia, and it worked. The Episcopalian minister prayed with and for me. The Mother Superior and nuns of the convent next to our house held me up to heaven for relief twice a day. A distant relative, who was a Christian Science reader, held the thought for me. Every incantation, magic, and herbal formula known was brought out, and she got 2 good nurses and the town's best doctors. Her method was practical. I got well. She was loving and firm with her family, 3 girls and me. Trained us in housework, dishwashing, clothes washing, and manners. When angered, she had a terrible eye, which could blanch the skin off a bad child as easily as if he were a boiled almond. When I recovered from my pneumonia, it came time for me to learn to walk again. I had been 9 weeks in bed, and the muscles had gone lax, and the laziness of recovery had set in. When I was helped up, every nerve cried, and the wound in my side, which had been opened to drain the pus from the pleural cavity, pained horribly. I fell back in bed, crying, "I can't do it. I can't get up." Olive fixed me with her terrible eye. "Get up," she said. "Your father has worked all day and sat up all night. He's gone into debt for you. Now get up." And I got up. Debt was an ugly word and an ugly concept to Olive. A bill unpaid past the 15th of the month was a debt. The word had connotations of dirt and slovenliness and dishonor. Olive, who truly believed that her family was the best in the world, quite snobbishly would not permit it to be touched by debt. She planted that terror of debt so deeply in her children that even now, in a changed economic pattern where indebtedness is a part of living, I become restless when a bill is 2 days overdue. Olive never accepted the time payment plan when it became popular. A thing bought on time was a thing you did not own and for which you were in debt. She saved for things she wanted, and this meant that the neighbors had new gadgets as much as 2 years before we did. Olive had great courage. Perhaps it takes courage to raise children. And I must tell you what she did about the First World War. Her thinking was not international. Her first boundary was the geography of her family. Second, her town, Salinas. And finally, there was a dotted line, not clearly defined, which was the county line. Thus, she did not quite believe in the war. Not even when Troop C, our militia cavalry, was called out, loaded its horses on a train, and set out for the open world. Martin Hopps lived around the corner from us. He was wide, short, red-haired. His mouth was wide, and he had red eyes. He was almost the shyest boy in Salinas. To say good morning to him was to make him itch with self-consciousness. He belonged to Troop C because the armory had a basketball court. If the Germans had known Olive and had been sensible, they would have gone out of their way not to anger her. But they didn't know, or they were stupid. When they killed Martin Hopps, they lost the war, because that made my mother mad, and she took out after them. She had liked Martin Hopps. He had never hurt anyone. When they killed him, Olive declared war on the German Empire. She cast about for a weapon. Knitting helmets and socks was not deadly enough for her. For a time, she put on a Red Cross uniform and met other ladies similarly dressed in the armory, where bandages were rolled and reputations unrolled. That was all right, but it was not driving at the heart of the Kaiser. Olive wanted blood for the life of Martin Hopps. She found her weapon in Liberty Bonds. She had never sold anything in her life beyond an occasional angel cake for the altar guild in the basement of the Episcopal Church. But she began to sell bonds by the bale. She brought ferocity to her work. I think she made people afraid not to buy them. And when they did buy from Olive, she gave them a sense of actual combat, of putting a bayonet in the stomach of Germany. As her sales skyrocketed and stayed up, the Treasury Department began to notice this new Amazon. First, there came mimeographed letters of commendation. Then real letters, signed by the Secretary of the Treasury, and not with a rubber stamp, either. We were proud, but not so proud as when prizes began to arrive. A German helmet, too small for any of us to wear. A bayonet, a jagged piece of shrapnel set on an ebony base. Since we weren't eligible for armed conflict beyond marching with wooden guns, our mother's war seemed to justify us. And then she outdid herself, and outdid everyone in our part of the country. She quadrupled her already fabulous record, and she was awarded the fairest prize of all, a ride in an army airplane. Oh, we were proud kids. Even vicariously, this was an eminence we could hardly stand. But my poor mother... I must tell you that there are certain things in the existence of which my mother did not believe, against any possible evidence to the contrary. One was a bad Hamilton, and another was the airplane. The fact that she had seen them didn't make her believe in them one bit more. In the light of what she did, I have tried to imagine how she felt. Her soul must have crawled with horror. For how can you fly in something that does not exist? As a punishment, the ride would have been cruel and unusual, but it was a prize, a gift, an honor, and an eminence. She must have looked into our eyes and seen the shining idolatry there and understood that she was trapped. Not to have gone would have let her family down. She was surrounded, and there was no honorable way out save death. Once she had decided to go up on the non-existent thing, she seemed to have no idea whatever that she would survive it. Olive made her will, took lots of time with it, and had it checked to be sure it was legal. Then she opened her rosewood box, wherein were the letters her husband had written to her in courtship, and since. And we had not known he wrote poetry to her, but he had. She built a fire in the grate and burned every letter. They were hers, and she wanted no other human to see them. She bought all new underwear. She had a horror of being found dead with mended, or worse, unmended underclothes. I think perhaps she saw the wide, twisted mouth and embarrassed eyes of Martin Hopps on her, and felt that in some way she was reimbursing him for his stolen life. She was very gentle with us, and didn't notice a badly washed dinner plate that left a greasy stain on the dish towel. This glory was scheduled to take place at the Salinas Racetrack and Rodeo Grounds. We were driven to the track in an army automobile, feeling more solemn and golden than at a good funeral. Our father was working at the Spreckles Sugar Factory, 5 miles from town, and couldn't get off, or perhaps he didn't want to, for fear he couldn't stand the strain. But Olive had made arrangements, on pain of not going up, for the plane to try to fly as far as the sugar factory before it crashed. I realized now that the several hundred people who had gathered simply came to see the airplane, but at that time we thought that they were there to do my mother honor. Olive wasn't a tall woman, and at that age she had begun to put on weight. We had to help her out of the car. She was probably stiff with fright, but her little chin was set. The plane stood in the field around which the racetrack was laid out. It was appallingly little and flimsy. An open cockpit biplane with wooden struts tied with piano wire. The wings were covered with canvas. Olive was stunned. She went to the side as an ox to the knife. Over the clothes she was convinced were her burial clothes, two sergeants slipped on a coat, a padded coat, and a flight coat, and she grew rounder and rounder with each layer. Then a leather helmet and goggles, and with a little button of a nose and her pink cheeks, you really had something. She looked like a goggled ball. The two sergeants hoisted her bodily into the cockpit and wedged her in. She filled the opening completely. As they strapped her in, she suddenly came to life and began waving frantically for attention. One of the soldiers climbed up, listened to her, came over to my sister Mary, and led her to the side of the plane. Olive was tugging at the thick padded flight glove on her left hand. She got her hands free, took off her engagement ring with its tiny diamond, and handed it down to Mary. She set her gold wedding ring firmly, pulled the gloves back on, and faced the front. The pilot climbed into the front cockpit, and one of the sergeants threw his weight on the wooden propeller. The little ship taxied away and turned, and down the field it roared and staggered into the air. And Olive was looking straight ahead, and probably her eyes were closed. We followed it with our eyes as it swept up and away, leaving a lonesome silence behind it. The bond committee, the friends and relatives, the simple, unhonored spectators didn't think of leaving the field. The plane became a speck in the sky toward Spreckles and disappeared. It was 15 minutes before we saw it again, flying serenely and very high. Then, to our horror, it seemed to stagger and fall. It fell endlessly, caught itself, climbed, and made a loop. One of the sergeants laughed. For a moment, the plane steadied, and then it seemed to go crazy. It barrel-rolled, made Immelmann turns, inside and outside loops, and turned over and flew over the field upside down. We could see the black bullet, which was our mother's helmet. One of the soldiers said quietly, "I think he's gone nuts. She's not a young woman." The airplane landed steadily enough and ran up to the group. The motor died. The pilot climbed out, shaking his head in perplexity. "Goddamnedest woman I ever saw," he said. He reached up and shook Olive's nerveless hand and walked hurriedly away. It took 4 men and quite a long time to get Olive out of the cockpit. She was so rigid that they could not bend her. We took her home and put her to bed, and she didn't get up for 2 days. What had happened came out slowly. The pilot talked some, and Olive talked some, and both stories had to be put together before they made sense. They had flown out and circled the Spreckles sugar factory as ordered. Circled it three times, so that their father would be sure to see. And then the pilot thought of a joke. He meant no harm. He shouted something, and his face looked contorted. Olive couldn't hear over the noise of the engine. The pilot throttled down and shouted, "Stunt!" It was a kind of joke. Olive saw his goggled face, and the slipstream caught his word and distorted it. What Olive heard was the word, "Stuck." Well, she thought, here it is, just as I knew it would be. Here was her death. Her mind flashed to see if she had forgotten anything. Will made, letters burned, new underwear, plenty of food in the house for dinner. She wondered whether she had turned out the light in the back room. It was all in a second. Then she thought there might be an outside chance of survival. The young soldier was obviously frightened, and fear might be the worst thing that could happen to him in handling the situation. If she gave way to the panic that lay on her heart, it might frighten him more. She decided to encourage him. She smiled brightly and nodded to give him courage. And then the bottom fell out of the world. When he leveled out of his loop, the pilot looked back again and shouted, "More?" Olive was way beyond hearing anything. But her chin was set, and she was determined to help the pilot so that he would not be too afraid before they hit the earth. She smiled and nodded again. At the end of each stunt, he looked back, and each time she encouraged him. Afterward, he said it over and over. "She's the goddamnedest woman I ever saw. I tore up the rule book, and she wanted more. Good Christ, what a pilot she would have made."
Chapter 15. Adam sat like a contented cat on his land. From the entrance to the little draw under a giant oak, which dipped its roots into the underground water, he could look out over the acres lying away to the river and across to an alluvial flat and then up the rounded foothills on the western side. It was a fair place even in the summer when the sun laced into it. A line of river willows and sycamores banded it in the middle, and the western hills were yellow-brown with feed. For some reason, the mountains to the west of the Salinas Valley have a thicker skin of earth on them than have the eastern foothills, so that the grass is richer there. Perhaps the peaks store rain and distribute it more evenly, and perhaps, being more wooded, they draw more rainfall. Very little of the Sanchez, now Trask, place was under cultivation. But Adam, in his mind, could see the wheat growing tall and squares of green alfalfa near the river. Behind him, he could hear the rackety hammering of the carpenters brought all the way from Salinas to rebuild the old Sanchez house. Adam had decided to live in the old house. Here was a place in which to plant his dynasty. The manure was scraped out, the old floors torn up, neck-rubbed window casings ripped away. New, sweet wood was going in, pine sharp with resin and velvety redwood, and a new roof of long split shakes. The old thick walls sucked in coat after coat of whitewash made with lime and salt water, which, as it dried, seemed to have a luminosity of its own. He planned a permanent seat. A gardener had trimmed the ancient roses, planted geraniums, laid out the vegetable plat, and brought the living spring in little channels to wander back and forth through the garden. Adam foretasted comfort for himself and his descendants. In a shed covered with tarpaulins lay the heavy crated furniture sent from San Francisco and carted out from King City. He would have good living, too. Lee, his pigtailed Chinese cook, had made a special trip to Pajaro to buy the pots and kettles and pans, kegs, jars, copper and glass for his kitchen. A new pigsty was building far from the house and downwind, with chicken and duck runs near and a kennel for the dogs to keep the coyotes away. It was no quick thing, Adam contemplated, to be finished and ready in a hurry. His men worked deliberately and slowly. It was a long job. Adam wanted it well done.
He inspected every wooden joint, stood off to study paint samples on a shingle. In the corner of his room, catalogs piled up. Catalogs for machinery, furnishings, seeds, fruit trees. He was glad now that his father had left him a rich man. In his mind, a darkness was settling over his memory of Connecticut. Perhaps the hard, flat light of the West was blotting out his birthplace. When he thought back to his father's house, to the farm, the town, to his brother's face, there was a blackness over all of it, and he shook off the memories. Temporarily, he had moved Kathy into the white-painted, clean spare house of Bordoni, there to await the home and the child. There was no doubt whatever that the child would be finished well before the house was ready, but Adam was unhurried. "I want it built strong," he directed over and over. "I want it to last. Copper nails and hard wood. Nothing to rust and rot." He wasn't alone in his preoccupation with the future. The whole valley, the whole West was that way. It was a time when the past had lost its sweetness and its sap. You'd go a good long road before you'd find a man, and he very old, who wished to bring back a golden past. Men were notched and comfortable in the present, hard and unfruitful as it was, but only as a doorstep into a fantastic future. Rarely did two men meet, or three stand in a bar, or a dozen gnaw tough venison in camp, that the valley's future, paralyzing in its grandeur, didn't come up, not as conjecture, but as a certainty. "It'll be, who knows, maybe in our lifetime," they said. And people found happiness in the future according to their present lack. Thus a man might bring his family down from a hill ranch in a drag, a big box nailed on oaken runners which pulled bumping down the broken hills. In the straw of the box, his wife would brace the children against the tooth-shattering, tongue-biting crash of the runners against stone and ground. And the father would set his heels and think, "When the roads come in, then will be the time. Why, we'll sit high and happy in a surrey and get clear into King City in 3 hours. And what more in the world could you want than that?" Or let a man survey his grove of live oak trees, hard as coal and hotter, the best firewood in the world. In his pocket might be a newspaper with a squib, "Oak cordwood is bringing $10 a cord in Los Angeles." "Why, hell, when the railroad puts a branch out there, I could lay it down neat, broke up, and seasoned right beside the track for $1.50 a cord. Let's go whole hog and say the Southern Pacific will charge $3.50 to carry it. That's still $5 a cord, and there's 3,000 cords in that little grove alone. That's $15,000 right there." There were others who prophesied, with rays shining on their foreheads, about the sometime ditches that would carry water all over the valley. Who knows, maybe in our lifetime. Or deep wells with steam engines to pump the water up out of the guts of the world. Can you imagine? Just think what this land would raise with plenty of water. Why, it will be a friggin' garden. Another man, but he was crazy, said that someday there'd be a way, maybe ice, maybe some other way, to get a peach like this here I got in my hand clear to Philadelphia. In the towns, they talked of sewers and inside toilets, and some already had them. And arc lights on the street corners. Salinas had those. And telephones. There wasn't any limit, no boundary at all, to the future. And it would be so a man wouldn't have room to store his happiness. Contentment would flood, raging, down the valley like the Salinas River in March of a 30-inch year. They looked over the flat, dry, dusty valley and the ugly mushroom towns, and they saw loveliness. Who knows? Maybe in our lifetime. That's one reason you couldn't laugh too much at Samuel Hamilton. He let his mind range more deliciously than any other. And it didn't sound so silly when you heard what they were doing in San Jose. Where Samuel went haywire was wondering whether people would be happy when all that came. Happy? He's haywire now. Just let us get it, and we'll show you happiness. And Samuel could remember hearing of a cousin of his mother's in Ireland, a knight, and rich and handsome, and anyway shot himself on a silken couch, sitting beside the most beautiful woman in the world, who loved him.
There's a capacity for appetite, Samuel said, that a whole heaven and earth of cake can't satisfy.
Adam Trask nosed some of his happiness into futures, but there was present contentment in him, too. He felt his heart smack up against his throat when he saw Kathy sitting in the sun, quiet, her baby growing, and a transparency to her skin that made him think of the angels on Sunday school cards. Then a breeze would move her bright hair, or she would raise her eyes, and Adam would swell out in his stomach with a pressure of ecstasy that was close kin to grief. If Adam rested like a sleek-fed cat on his land, Kathy was cat-like too. She had the inhuman attribute of abandoning what she could not get and of waiting for what she could get. These two gifts gave her great advantages. Her pregnancy had been an accident. When her attempt to abort herself failed and the doctor threatened her, she gave up that method. That doesn't mean she reconciled herself to pregnancy. She sat it out as she would have weathered an illness. Her marriage to Adam had been the same. She was trapped, and she took the best possible way out. She hadn't wanted to go to California either, but other plans were denied her for the time being. As a very young child, she had learned to win by using the momentum of her opponent. It was easy to guide a man's strength where it was impossible to resist him. Very few people in the world could have known that Kathy didn't want to be where she was and in the condition she was. She relaxed and waited for the change she knew must come sometime. Kathy had the one quality required of a great and successful criminal. She trusted no one, confided in no one. Herself was an island. It's probable that she didn't even look at Adam's new land or building house, or turn his towering plans to reality in her mind, because she didn't intend to live here after her sickness was over, after her trap opened. But to his questions she gave proper answers. To do otherwise would be waste motion, and dissipated energy, and foreign to a good cat. "See, my darling, how the house lies, windows looking down the valley? It's beautiful. You know, it may sound foolish, but I find myself trying to think the way old Sanchez did 100 years ago. How was the valley then? He must have planned so carefully. You know, he had pipes. He did, made out of redwood, with a hole bored or burned through to carry the water down from the spring. We dug up some pieces of it."
"That's remarkable," she said. "He must have been clever."
"I'd like to know more about him. From the way the house sets, the trees he left, the shape and proportion of the house, he must have been a kind of artist."
"He was a Spaniard, wasn't he? They're artistic people, I've heard. I remember in school about a painter. No, he was a Greek."
"I wonder where I could find out about old Sanchez."
"Well, somebody must know."
"All of his work and planning. And Bordoni kept cows in the house. You know what I wonder about most?"
"What, Adam?"
"I wonder if he had a Kathy, and who she was." She smiled and looked down and away from him.
"The things you say."
"He must have had. He must have had. I never had energy or direction, or, well, even a very great desire to live before I had you."
"Adam, you embarrass me. Adam, be careful. Don't joggle me. It hurts."
"I'm sorry. I'm so clumsy."
"No, you're not. You just don't think. Should I be knitting or sewing, do you suppose? I'm so comfortable just sitting."
"We'll buy everything we need. You just sit and be comfortable. I guess in a way you're working harder than anyone here. But the pay is wonderful."
"Adam, the scar on my forehead isn't going to go away, I'm afraid."
"The doctor said it would fade in time."
"Well, sometimes it seems to be getting fainter, and then it comes back. Don't you think it's darker today?"
"No, I don't." But it was. It looked like a huge thumbprint, even to whorls of wrinkled skin. He put his finger near, and she drew her head away.
"Don't," she said. "It's tender to the touch. It turns red if you touch it."
"It'll go away. It just takes a little time, that's all." She smiled as he turned, but when he walked away, her eyes were flat and directionless. She shifted her body restlessly. The baby was kicking. She relaxed, and all her muscles loosened. She waited. Lee came near where her chair was set under the biggest oak tree.
Missy likey tea?
No. Yes, I would, too. Her eyes inspected him, and her inspection couldn't penetrate the dark brown of his eyes. He made her uneasy. Kathy had always been able to shovel into the mind of any man and dig up his impulses and his desires, but Lee's brain gave and repelled like rubber. His face was lean and pleasant, his forehead broad, firm, and sensitive, and his lips curled in a perpetual smile. His long, black, glossy, braided queue, tied at the bottom with a narrow piece of black silk, hung over his shoulder and moved rhythmically against his chest. When he did violent work, he curled his queue on top of his head. He wore cotton narrow trousers, black heelless slippers, and a frogged Chinese smock. Whenever he could, he hid his hands in his sleeves as though he were afraid for them, as most Chinese did in that day.
"I bling little table,"
he said, bowed slightly, and shuffled away. Kathy looked after him, and her eyebrows drew down in a scowl. She wasn't afraid of Lee, yet she wasn't comfortable with him either. But he was a good and respectful servant, the best. And what harm could he do her? The summer progressed, and the Salinas River retired underground or stood in green pools under high banks. The cattle lay drowsing all day long under the willows and only moved out at night to feed. An umber tone came to the grass, and the afternoon winds, blowing inevitably down the valley, started a dust that was like fog, and raised it into the sky almost as high as the mountaintops. The wild oat roots stood up like niggerheads where the winds blew the earth away. Along a polished earth, pieces of straw and twigs scampered until they were stopped by some rooted thing, and little stones rolled crookedly before the wind. It became more apparent than ever why old Sanchez had built his house in the little draw, for the wind and the dust did not penetrate, and the spring, while it diminished, still gushed ahead of clear, cold water. But Adam, looking out over his dry, dust-obscured land, felt the panic the eastern man always does at first in California. In a Connecticut summer, 2 weeks without rain is a dry spell, and 4 a drought. If the countryside isn't green, it's dying. But in California, it does not ordinarily rain at all between the end of May and the 1st of November. The eastern man, though he has been told, feels the earth is sick in the rainless months. Adam sent Lee with a note to the Hamilton place to ask Samuel to visit him and discuss the boring of some wells on his new place. Samuel was sitting in the shade, watching his son Tom design and build a revolutionary coon trap, when Lee drove up in the Trask cart. Lee folded his hands in his sleeves and waited. Samuel read the note. "Tom," he said, "do you think you could keep the estate going while I run down and talk water with a dry man?"
"Why don't I go with you? You might need some help."
"At talking? That I don't. It won't come to digging for some time, if I'm any judge. With wells, there's got to be a great deal of talk. 500 or 600 words for every shovel of dirt."
"I'd like to go. It's Mr. Trask, isn't it? I didn't meet him when he came here."
"You'll do that when the digging starts. I'm older than you. I've got first claim on the talk. You know, Tom, a coon is going to reach his pretty little hand through here and let himself out. You know how clever they are."
"See this piece here? It screws on and turns down here. You couldn't get out of that yourself."
"I'm not so clever as a coon." "I think you've worked it out, though. Tomboy, would you saddle doxology while I go tell your mother where I'm going?"
"I'm Ling Lig," said Lee.
"Well, I have to come home sometime."
"I bling back."
"Nonsense," said Samuel. "I'll lead my horse in and ride back." Samuel sat in the buggy beside Lee and his clobber-footed saddle horse shuffled clumsily behind.